It's super fun today to be here today with Rick Walker, who is an entrepreneur and thinker and host of the Rick Walker podcast. And he's interviewed all the important people in the world. And he's also author of 9 Steps to Build a Life of Meaning, How to Unlock Your Mind, Happiness, Power, and Your Enemy's Demise. And he has some absolutely knockdown, drag out recommendations at the front of the book from John Vervaeke and Paul Vanderclay of all people, and also Ben Carson, which I thought was super interesting. I've been a fan of Ben Carson's for I don't know, maybe 40 years. I started reading stuff from him a long time ago. But I thought before we start looking at the particulars of the book, maybe there's one story from the book that stands out to you right now that you'd like to share with the listeners.
Well, Karen, first off, it's a joy to be with you as always. I really appreciate your invitation and your hospitality the other times I've come on. And so I'm looking forward to our conversation very much today. I think that, one of the elements that I remember growing up was a summer when my dad and I were out of work and we were just trying to figure out what we were going to do for the summer. And we both knew a little bit about watches. And so we decided to go to yard sales to ask if they had any old watches that we could fix up. And everyone, without an exception, all summer long, all said, no, we don't have any old gold watches. We don't have any watches. We don't have anything like that. And so but we would linger for a second, and they would, most of the time, they would remember that they had this set of old watches, broken watches that were inherited to them. They always threw them in like a box. And it was weird because many times it was a cigar box. And they would throw in the cigar box and they would just kind of stuff it up on a shelf or under a bed or in a drawer somewhere. And it would lay there for years. And so the more we lingered, the more they remember, well, we do have this. There's this one watch. There's just two watches. Let me go inside and get it. But at like a yard sale, you always bring everything out into the sun. Well, in this case, these are the things that they left behind. And what we discovered over time was that these watches, some of them had an immense value, but they always underappreciated the value because they never earned it. They were given to, and they always assumed it was worthless. And the irony of that was that they left these broken down pieces of gold watches, these mementos of the past for people that they love very dearly, in the shadows of dusty wisdom, generally on bookshelves. And they never remembered they were there. But we could take those broken watches and we could take them a street or two down, growing up in Corpus Christi, just a few streets down, and we would know a collector or someone that would realize the true value, and they would pay us a premium for that. And so we were able to, what's called arbitrage that transaction, take one item from a person that didn't know the true value of it and bring it just a few streets over, clean it up, maybe do some minor repairs, and sell it for much more to an investor that realized its true worth. And I thought to myself, how poignant that is what many of us do in this little area, this little corner of the internet, where we look at symbols, we look at these things that the universe and God is mirroring onto us, and we see how relevant they could be for our lives if we were just to take notice of them. But since we didn't earn it, we sometimes just kind of toss it aside and we forget about it and we never realize that it has true value. So this is sort of a call to pay attention to what's around us, to take note of the little things, the little intricacies, these little things that we toss aside, because there's meaning hidden everywhere.
Well, that story stood out to me too when I read it, because you're the first person who's ever been able to explain arbitrage to me in a way that I could understand. And that story made it very clear. Because I mean, I'm always hearing about arbitrage with real estate and arbitrage with dying companies and all this stuff. And I had never really got and there's of course the movie with Richard Gere, was it? And what's happening here? But the way you explain it made it very clear to me. So I was actually going to tell you how much I appreciate that. And the way you described it is there are undervalued assets and we don't recognize their true value. And in between the undervalued asset and the true value, there's a delta. And all the opportunity lies in that delta. And that certainly is true as well of, Jordan Peterson always talks about going back and rescuing your dead father. But it, part of that is remembering all the things that our father and mother taught us that at the time we just thought, oh, they're stupid. They don't know anything.
Yes.
The older we get, the more we go back. And those are treasures that we just did not value at the time.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's also really poignant that with arbitrage, for instance, there's a lot of people sort of in this space that talk about I'm a synthesizer. I like to idea synthesize. I like to take concepts from one domain and use them in the other domain. You see Pajot doing this a lot. I had a problem with that. And I used that word for years. I had the problem with that for me, especially me calling myself a synthesizer, because there was no object at which the pursuit was aimed. And that's why the term arbitrage really resonated with me, because it's something I do on a day in, day out basis with investments in real estate. But also it's the search for that delta that you talked about, Karen. It's this the search for the unknown but yet expected. And so we've got to figure out a way to uncover that. And it often presents itself in relationships just as much as it does in history and art and stories.
Well, I think that's one of the things that must have made it very difficult for you in putting together this book, because you've had a very complicated, tumultuous life, very exciting. Lots of scary things have happened, and lots of successes and lots of failures, and then to try to put that all together with this framework that you build of 9 steps. And so you set it up in a kind of companion framework so that there's a downside and then there's a redemption of the downside into the upside. And that repeats itself 3 times, I think, in the course of the book, which kind of helps give it a frame and guides the reader through this really amazing life that you've had. There's rather startling conclusions that you've made in the book. And one of them I wanted to ask you about, you go into this quite early in the book. You give an example of a man who discovers his young daughter being molested, and he beats the guy to death. And so I have to just be honest with you. Part of this book is really hard for me to understand as a woman, because women do think differently than men do. And my husband is always trying to explain these things to me. And when I read that section, I thought, oh, my husband would just resonate with that. He would say, right on. But I'm just like cringing. So I wonder if you want to talk about that a little bit. The quote I got from the book was, "Go into battle and kill your enemies, not because you hate those in front of you, but because you love those behind you."
Yeah, and that is a slight theft of the thinking of Chesterton when he wrote a very similar phrase about a century ago. So you can look at this one of two ways. And first off, let me sort of set a premise here. I wrote the book for men that are within this sort of this Cervakian meaning crisis. And so these ones, 25 to 45. I'm over 45, so I'm sort of out of it, but I don't escape it. I still have these same complications with my own life. But I'm trying to speak to that specific subset, and more so, I'm trying to speak to people that are not from a specific faith tradition. Maybe they've grown up in the faith tradition, but they're not, entrenched in one right now. And so, like when I walk around at church, like there's a lot of people that have a problem with that first chapter, and that's my intent is to sort of, I think I use the phrase, shock them with the prod of divine correctness. And so you can look at this one of two ways. I want to get to the psychological way here in a second, but let me talk about the spiritual manner, especially from the Christian perspective. There's this interesting little remark, I believe it's in Romans 11 or 12, where Paul says that you must that hate what is evil, and there's a semicolon, cling to what is good. I am not an educated person. I was grew up in the public school systems, and I was always told that when I saw a little semicolon, which we never knew how properly to use. that we would just read it as an equal sign, that if there's some sort of balance in play and that whatever's on both sides. There's some mimicking of the two in certain cases. And so when I read that statement from Paul, it became very apparent that the only way to get a bit of the good is to hate the evil. Not necessarily the evil man that's making the evil happen, but the evil that's actually being manifest through that man, if that makes sense. And I actually had an interesting conversation with Dr. Vervaeke over email about this before he gave me the very kind blurb and recommendation. Obviously, he had, sort of a Buddhist psychological background. He is not very very fond of hate and that sort of thing. But there's something really truer about the nature of going and finding the evil manifestation around you. And if you have nothing else to do with your life, to commit your life to that. And that's sort of the spiritual message for that avatar man that I wrote the book for. But then also on the psychological level, these are many of these men, some research shows 70 to 80% of them that are in a sort of a loveless type of environment. They've never loved. They're in pursuit of love. They have no positive vision of what's possible for their lives, only a negative vision of what they don't want. They have to attach themselves to something that's greater than themselves. And since they can never foresee, they never seen something that they want. They never seen someone living the type of life that they would dream to have. They only know what pain feels like. But if we speak into them and we communicate with them that the purpose of light is to invade the darkness, therefore the purpose of a good man is to invade the evil that he sees around him, that something within our DNA calls us out to fight the evil that we see around us. That's not a statement of Christian or Judaism or spiritual reality. It's a statement of, I think, how reality works in and of itself. That a good man is always called to fight the evil. And if you can find that which breaks your heart, that thing that challenges you, that really stirs you, whether it's the sex website that doesn't respect minors, maybe it's the child trafficking ring that's very present in your community. Maybe it is that fentanyl that's really hurt your family, that's hurting the public school system. There's some manifest evil around you. And if you can somehow cobble together a bit of energy to attack that one thing that hurts you, you have hope to get to move. And that's really what the purpose of chapter one is, which is choose one worthy enemy, is to get these men to move towards something. Even if it's the wrong way, get them to move. Because if we can get them to move, we can begin to rip away the comfort enslaving their potential. And we can therefore also try to get them out of this immobility, this indifference to life, and be able to give them a challenge worth living for in the end. But we got to get them to do something initially, and that's my challenge.
Well, I think it might also be helpful for women like myself, and I mean, I've grown past some of this, but younger women especially who have gotten into this mindset of thinking about toxic masculinity, that somehow that's representative of toxic masculinity. But the quote that always comes to my mind, and I'm going to get it wrong, I know, is rough men stand ready to do violence on your behalf as you sleep safely at night.
I like that. I like that. I've never heard that before.
I can't remember who said it. It might have been Teddy Roosevelt. But I mean, it's idea that we just don't want to think about. We lay peacefully in our beds at night, but there are all around the world rough men, and they have to be rough men to do the work that they do, standing ready to protect us. And
Yes.
so when I hear my husband say, "Man, if that guy had done that to me, I would have ripped his head off," I just recoil at that. And yet, I am thankful that I have someone like that by my side, so that if someone invaded our home, I know, whether he would be successful or not, he would do everything he could to protect me.
That's right. That's right. And I think there's something to be said for having that threatening force existing somewhere in the world. Like there's always the chance that there's an America that's there that can stand in and do the right thing, that can bring justice to the situation. I also think that, you begin with the story of the rancher who saw his daughter abused by the ranch hand and killed the ranch hand. There's something right about immediate justice, something that the victims of 9/11 didn't get a chance to see, something that was stolen from the airmen that were murdered at Pearl Harbor without a chance to know what was happening. Those in the concentration camps, they never got to see their own justice. And I think one of the promises of Scripture seems to be that you shall see your redemption, you shall see ultimate justice with your own eyes. These very eyes that we see with now will somehow be resurrected in the end, maybe for the purpose not only of envisioning, glory and beauty himself, but also to see that redemption, to see that justice put on trial once and for all, and for things to be set right. And so that's a little bit what I mirror in that first chapter that you then begin to see towards the end of the chapter, this idea of the vision, the idea of vision being your ultimate redemption. And so that's something thematically that I like to see play out, because that's something that I really believe. I never really found a scripture that backs that up, but it just seems something that seems like that's something that's really, really true.
So I think this is still in the first chapter, but one of the stories you go into that reflects this too is the political loss that you suffered. You were running for office, and you made some mistakes in your campaign that resulted in a loss. This was very vivid for me because I suffered a political loss back in 1982. For a lot of reasons, which I'm not going to go into right now. I had a win first. I served in office for 2 years, and then I lost on the back end. but I remember what that felt like. It's a crushing, even if you can see it coming, it's a crushing feeling. But you didn't see it coming, and then the numbers come across the screen, and wow, that a massive underestimation of what a loss could feel like. So I wonder if you'd like to talk about that a little bit.
So our home flooded in Hurricane Harvey back in 2017, and our community was in disarray. A couple of weeks later, our congressman from for many, many years announced he was retiring. So the way that funding in Congress works is that generally those that have more power, more seniority, more fundraising capacity, those are the people that have a little bit more clout in Congress. And so when you're in a flooded community that's hit with, all sorts of, disaster, not only to rebuild, but also to remediate the water infrastructure to be able to, save your community from doing it again. This guy is going to retire. It became obvious that I need to step up and do something. And so I decided to run for that congressional seat. Along the way, there were nine other people that got not eight other people that got in the nine-person race. And it became, I think at that time, maybe it was the most expensive congressional race in history. I didn't know I was getting into that, but that's what it ended up being. It was expensive, not because of me, but because we had a couple of well-to-do candidates that were in the race. And so we hired one of the great polling companies out of DC to run the polling, and everything showed that, out of nine candidates, you have to get 50% plus one to move on. So there would be a runoff because no one's going to hit 50%. And it showed that I would be one of those two the entire time. And suddenly at the very last minute, some polling shift. There were some tax ads that were dropped. I dropped many of them on one of my opponents, and she dropped them on me and some others. And so it sort of shifted things around from the polling standpoint, and ended up losing, obviously, from that. And it was just really a painful time,
So
especially,
wait,
a congr
the result of the negative campaigning that caused people to turn against you and the other candidate that the two of you were kind of lobbing attack ads at each other, and then both of you were out of the running because of that. So
Yes,
you had
yes, yes.
originally been in the lead, the two of you. You ended up at the bottom.
That's correct. That's correct. And so, yeah, I lobbed about 1,000 TV spots at her negative, and the negative charges were very well researched. I'll say that. So we knew exactly the maximal statement to say, true statement to say that removed the maximum number of supporters. And so we just did that 1,000 times on TV. She responded with two kind of oversized postcards with me on it. One of them was basically referring to me to as the devil and a job killer. And I created more jobs than all the other candidates combined, which is sort of the funny thing. And she sent it out to like 800,000 constituents. That's the entirety of the district. And then she did it again. So she sent it off. It was a primary, which means only half the voters voted it. She sent it to one. She went and just sent it to all the voters from what I was told, and twice. And so it was pretty brutal. And she and I have since made up from that. I think
That's
she's,
good.
yeah. I think I mean we're not best friends by any means, but she's reentering the political sphere now from what I hear, and I wish her the best of luck. But yeah, it was a pretty brutal way to defeat. But I decided that it would be better for anyone else but her to win. And I don't know what the reasoning on her side was. I mean, I'm sure she saw the polling as well, because we were the only two candidates that could really afford the polling. Very expensive. And the polling ended up being for both of our demises.
Well, one of the lessons that you got from that was weak men like me, you said, live by comparison.
Yeah. That's the sad thing. It's men like me in that state that look with envy on the people that have greater popularity in political case, the people that have, more sort of brain power in the online space, people that have more charisma on the online space. We look at that and we compare our lives, not realizing that there's challenges there that we never see. There's also things that they've overcome that we can never imagine. And so whenever we free ourselves from looking by comparison with somebody else, and we look at by comparison of what we could have been or what we were, we begin to move in the right direction. It begins to be a relationship based off of not envy of others, not jealousy of others, not competition with others, but a relationship with ourselves that's focused on a vision of what's possible for us in the future. And we begin to live in the future instead of living in the horizontalness of relationships.
Now, you talk about the aim, that everybody needs to have an aim towards an ideal in life. And that made me think about a quote from John Verbeke that he posted on X this week. He said, determining our meaning in terms of our purpose is dangerous. Why? Purpose is something you are working towards a goal. If you never reach it, your life was meaningless. Plus, the sense of meaning often vanishes once the goal is achieved. So he says more important is orientation. And that I thought about that when you said that about aim. You need to have an aim towards an ideal. That's an orientation rather than a purpose, because that orientation might give you lots of different purposes. Then you have to figure out how to organize your purposes, I guess.
Yeah, that's certainly the challenge. And I think you used the line in the book from Bruce Lee's book, Striking Thoughts, where he says that low aim is the only crime. Low aim is the only crime. And so that didn't work too well as a step. So I had to say aim high before I said that. But that's step two, aim high, aiming low is the only sin.
And what did that exactly mean? I mean, when you translate that from Bruce Lee, I mean, was he speaking in the physical material realm that when you aim low, that's unfair advantage because you're taking out your enemy at his weakest point? Or were you speaking metaphorically? What exactly do you mean that a low aim is the only sin?
I think that, he may have been speaking both. I was certainly speaking in the nature of value. And I think that's maybe a differentiation between however Vakey would think about this. Obviously, he has some interoperability between purpose and meaning. A lot of people will clump the two within the same definition. I write later in the book that the wisest mind looks into the most distant future for the most value reward that it can purchase with the currency of the present.
Okay, say that again a little slower because I don't think people are going to get it so fast.
And it's a monster statement. I'm sure I stole this from someone, Karen, but I can't find it. So, but the wisest mind looks into the most distant future for the most valued reward that it can purchase with the currency of the present.
Well,
So,
it sounds exactly like Jordan Peterson's philosophy, except that it's been collapsed into a sentence.
I think Frankl has a very similar philosophy as that. So that is the philosophy that puts within parameters the definition of what a wise meaning, wise purpose is, that the purpose that is in the pursuit, which I think Verveke would probably, have some agreement with that. But it's the object of the pursuit that redeems the purpose. And so the higher and further out, the more value the end goal, the purpose is the pursuit, the greater the purpose, the greater the meaning of the life is. And the goal for the human life is to attach itself to a purpose or an end goal or a most valued reward that is indestructible. And that's how we ideally will aim. Purpose and meaning, at the root of it, and this is the desire of humans and men especially, is we're looking for relevance in the end. We want to have matter. And relevance is always connected with the idea of indestructibility. And you have to get down to the idea of indestructibility. And I think that a lot of people from outside our faith system would have to say that they are focused on some sort of derivative of indestructibility. Maybe it's a flow state, maybe it's happiness, maybe it's the family. But either way, they're focused on a derivative of indestructibility. And this is why we have to keep pushing our boundaries out further and further and further into the future for weightier and weightier types of pursuits. Because we might have a semblance of meaning, but is merely a shadow of what indestructible meaning and purpose is. That gives ultimate relevance and ultimately gives some weight to one's life.
Well, in this whole concept of indestructibility, one of the things that you said later in the book is whatever can be destroyed, for example, anything that is in the physical, is less real than what can never be destroyed, the immaterial divine. So the most real thing is that which cannot be destroyed, basically, is what you're saying.
The idea of indestructibility is so pervasive through all the domains, not only religion, but also philosophy, also sort of beauty, whether you follow it from a trail to beauty, a trail to truth, a trail to power, you begin to get to down to the idea of indestructibility and permanence. And you got to eventually reach that as the ultimate goal along all those paths.
That makes me think of C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce, where he's talking about the reality of heaven and that it's so real that when the people are visiting from hell, those people are very insubstantial compared to the substantial reality of heaven, so that even the blades of grass feel like spears running up through their feet. Because they themselves are insubstantial. And
That's so good.
that which is most indestructible is the most real. So well, along with this idea of aim, one of the things you said is name your future self. You need an ideal to aim yourself. So name your future self. Could you give us an example of how that works?
So I'll give you an example from my own life. A few years ago, I was trying to think about how I want to come across whenever I spoke to groups or, communicate with people that I admired. And I really didn't have an identity there. And so I began to think about an alter ego. And this is just a little bit of the essence of what I'm talking about when I talk about your future self. I began to think about like what are the people that I admire most? What are the key attributes of those individuals? And so I thought about those people. And I came to the realization that what I want to be known as is three things. I want to be known as passionate, disciplined, and wise. Not that I am those things, but I desire to be known as those things. And so I began to build my reading and my learning and my mannerisms around those three things. I was not a very passionate person. Definitely wasn't very wise. I'm still not very wise. But I was very disciplined. And so I could use the discipline as the pathway to maybe build some passion. I began to take communication classes and speaking classes and become more pronounced in my support of different ideas. And the wisdom part just came as the regular activity of humbling myself to be obedient to people that are much wiser and higher and further along in head in life of mine than I am, and reading older books. And so that's the way, sort of the subsect, the sort of essence of what the future self is. And so if I can imagine that passionate, disciplined, and wise Rick that I would desire to be, I think about that person 20 or 30 or 50 years ahead of me, who's kind of followed that to its logical conclusion. And I think about what are the questions that future, best possible future self of myself would ask myself today. Like he would not ask me about like what makes you comfortable. He would ask me about what do I need to do right now to take the next step forward towards that person. He would ask me about like what tweet are you going to put out today? He would ask me about like what books am I going to read and what legacy am I going to leave behind for my kids? He wouldn't ask me about what are these people that are talking about me? What are they really saying and how do I defend myself? No, he's going to ask me about how am I going to love those people and move on ahead despite what people think about me. And so he's going to call me higher to myself. And I'm also going to assume that person also loves me more because it's myself. And so I set up this series of questions. And I think you'll see this, I believe, in every one of the chapters, this idea, think about your best possible future self and imagine that person asking you this. And then I list questions. And it's an element of self-reflection. It's also an element of seeing that there is a best possible future self that's evident, and you can imagine that person. You can communicate with that person, not in a spiritual way, but in a way that where you realize that you have more potential, and the more you imagine that potential, if you were to go back and read like a Goddard or someone like that, the more that you imagine that potential, the more it begins to actualize itself in reality over time. I mean, your todays are nothing more than the whiff of your futures. And so whatever our minds imagine, your reality will put together. And so that's one of those things that I've got to figure out a way to get people to communicate. And that whole idea came back from Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, that if a man has a responsibility or love that he can look forward in the future, even if that love has already died, he can survive through almost any tragedy.
Well, when I was reading that part of the book, I was thinking about how much that is similar, really, to painting, making a painting. I was going to say painting a work of art, but I'm not sure that I would want to call my paintings all works of art. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But the process of creating something, what actually my husband goes through the same process when he creates a new design for a product. It's this idea, you have the idea. So somehow ideas have causal power in the world, because if that idea is compelling enough to me, then I want to instantiate it in the world so I can share it with other people. So if the aim of my future self is compelling enough to me, I have to find a path to get there so that that can become instantiated in the world. And Dorothy Sayers talks about this in her book, The Mind of the Maker, which I'm always hammering on because it's such a great book. She describes it, the three parts, as the idea, which is eternal. I mean, it's not in the physical reality yet. It's an eternal idea. And then there's the energy. That part is the process, the entire process of the making. And that includes the physical resources required for it, the physical energy required to produce the product, the continual benchmarking, looking at where I am, bringing it back, comparing it to the idea, looking at the new context with new things that have happened and assessing that again, bringing it back to the idea. That whole process in there is called the energy. And then when it's complete, that's called the power, because now that thing has power in the world. It will influence people one way or another. And it seems like that's the same exact framework of what you're talking about with having the ideal of your future self. And the thing about that kind of vision is that your vision is always going to outrun your skill. So you have this picture of your future self when you're 25, maybe. You picture what you're going to be when you're 40. But by the time you're 35 and you've gone through a lot of life, maybe you've had to adjust that picture and maybe you've pushed it out a little farther. So that, and then you need to learn new skills to get there. So your vision is always running out ahead of your skill, which I like to think is God's gift to us. If it weren't that way, we wouldn't have to keep striving and we wouldn't be willing to face the challenges that we face in life.
Oh no, I agree. I love that. I love that. And I've been entranced by the painting over your right shoulder, the blue and red painting. That seems like it's got maybe a blue heart in the middle. It's the larger of the
Oh,
two.
wow.
And
I never thought about that. It does kind of look like a heart from a distance. It's actually I took it from a picture of some square dancers. But as I started as the image started arising on the canvas, I realized it's an image of family. And you probably can't see from this standpoint, but there's a man and wife, and then there's a daughter in the background, and kind of reminded me of our family because we have a daughter. So,
Yeah, no, I love that. And you can feel, I mean, again, I'm looking at it from on a tiny screen from a distance. And so, but I can sense the warmth, but also the energy that went into creating that. And I would say that the person that I know it's you, but the person that puts something like that together, your vision of what is possible is rooted in the future of what's possible, but it also brings sort of the information and the experience from the past. And so I can see I'm not a professional by any means, but I do love art. I think you see I talk about art quite a bit throughout the book. But I can see that passion, but also that there's a lot of warmth. There's some bright colors in that painting, but there's a lot of warmth in it. The way that you put that together. So I just, you know, I really do appreciate that. I love seeing that there.
So the next thing that you said about aim was aim to discover one high unifying truth to build your life around, for that is where true life lives. And I think this is where you were talking about. This was an amazing story where you were talking about, and I guess this is a true historical thing, about Alexander's dream and the dream of the priest of Israel, priest of Judah.
It was the high priest Jaddus. That's right.
Yes,
Yeah.
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of those stories that no one knows about. In fact, I interviewed who I believe to be one of the foremost authorities on Plato, Alexander the Great, and C.S. Lewis on my podcast last year. And I was telling him a little bit about the story. He said, "Where did you find that?" And I said, "What was in William Whiston's The Thundering Legion book from like 400 years ago? I don't know what it was, but it was a long time ago." And he said, "Well, I've never heard about this." I said, "Yeah, he cites Josephus and he cites I think Eusebius for the story." And I've gone back and read those two sources as well. And then I read William Whiston's, and William Whiston seems to put a little bit more, not theatrics, but it's a little bit more prescience on the story there. But yeah, it's this great story of Alexander the Great, who is alone praying one night, and he gets a vision. He gets a vision of a man in white, surrounded by men in purple robes, and he has this ephod or this sort of crown type of thing on his on his head, and it has the name of it's emblazoned with the name of God. And so everywhere he goes, he's kind of in the back of his mind searching for that, and he stumbles across Jerusalem, and right before he arrives in Jerusalem, again, this is probably the most dominant military force ever. Right before he arrives in Jerusalem, some say it may have been a day or two before, Jairus the high priest has this vision as well, where he is to open the gates to the attacker and let him in. And this vision that they both have ends up being what the natural man would think would be the complete demise, where the Jairus commands the gates to be open when he sees the approach of Alexander the Great's army, letting the invader in, the most powerful force, into the walls. And Alexander the Great ends up being there, seeing the gates open. He approaches by himself with Parmenion, his lieutenant. And if he had not approached by himself, he would have the military there. He would have the military to fight against him from the Jewish side. And the Jairus, the high priest, comes out to meet Alexander face to face. And had he not opened the gates and was obedient to his dreams, and had Alexander not been obedient to his dream and gone to, face this face to face, they would never realize that the priest himself was wearing the very crown with the name of God emblazoned that Alexander saw in his dream back in Macedon. And so it's a story about the idea that you must not only bow your knee to something that's higher, despite the power that you see manifest, it manifesting at this time, but also sometimes you have to do the opposite of what the reasonable thing to do would have been. They both did the opposite. Alexander put his entire identity at stake. He knelt before Jairus the high priest, and he actually ends up going into Jerusalem, going to the temple, and making a sacrifice in the temple, according to, I think, Eusebius. And so it is this crazy, crazy story where both sides did the opposite of what they should have done. But in the end, there was peace. And that ended up being one of the few cities that Alexander came across, set up to siege it, and didn't destroy. And it saved the Jewish people.
Well, it's especially amazing given that, I mean, Alexander took power when he was 21, is that right? And I think something like that, he didn't live all that long, but in the course of his very short life, he created a greater empire than had ever been created before, I think.
Yes.
And the army that he had with him when he came on Jerusalem must have been absolutely massive. So I can imagine all of Jerusalem shaking in their boots, wondering what is going to happen. But anyway, to think of a great conqueror like Alexander, recognizing that there was a power greater than him. And I just thought that was really a powerful story.
Yeah, and I think one other thing, I didn't fully answer your question, but I think one thing that you pointed out, the idea of sort of kneeling to something that's higher than you, is Alexander realized that it happened in his dreams, and then he saw it in reality, and therefore it had the nature, the curious little thing of unmanufacturability. It's something that could not be manufactured. It's not a trick. It's not a ma an act of magic. It's something that no one else could have possibly known what that crown looked like. But then he saw it in reality. And there are these glimmers of the divine that we were all exposed to, whether it be a comment of someone that you passed by. Maybe it was, that medical scare with one of your children. it there are these little glimmers of the indestructibility that's all around us, and they always, from my experience, almost always appear in an unmanufacturable state. And so whenever you begin to look for these sorts of threads, you see this obviously unmanufacturability that's tied to sort of that most distant indestructible type of objective. We begin to weave these themes together, and we begin to get maybe a higher dimension perspective of what we should be pursuing in life.
Well, of course, that makes me think of a later story. I shouldn't be making you tell all your stories because then you're giving us the whole book. But talk about an unmanufacturable story, the story of the time that you did the 7-day fast and what you discovered from that, and then what happened out of that is such an amazing story. And I you don't have to tell the whole story if you want to leave it as a surprise for people who get the book, that's fine too. But there were a couple of quotes leading up to that that I think are connected both to the story of Alexander and the story of the things that you learned in that 7-day fast. One is your chief error is standing when you should kneel and kneeling when you should take a stand. We saw that play out back in 2020 during a lot of the riots. And then also be conquered by the highest master you can find, and then get alone in silence. And I think that also connects up with the idea earlier about finding a worthy enemy. So let's just back up a little bit. The finding a worthy enemy is not just finding the enemy on the outside, but sometimes it's finding the enemy on the inside. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Most of us think that we have too many challenges, and what we should be looking for and working towards is lessening the burden of those challenges. But for me, and I suspect for many of the people that watch this podcast, that we really have to be thinking about the opposite of that. We need more challenge in our life. We're aiming at the lower challenges. We could be aiming at a higher challenge. And if we could figure out a way where we were to be that best possible future self, or in another way, putting it, kind of take that to this fullest logical conclusion, if you're an Orthodox, you would say this person that's reached theosis, this holy person, who you would aim to be, you would be able to look into your own soul and see, this is what I need. And I suspect we need challenges more than we need comforts. I suspect that we haven't worked hard enough. And I even say in the book that you've never met anyone that's worked hard enough on the right thing. We don't challenge ourselves enough. And when we don't challenge ourselves enough, we begin to victimize ourselves. And this is this funny little thing that happens within us. And Tolstoy writes about this in his Confessions, where we fail to take up the agency that God gave us whenever we run away or we balk or we try to dismiss challenges, we try to dismiss hardships, and we take up the comforts that are around us. And sometimes those challenges are meant to improve us. In fact, they're generally always meant to improve us. And if we can't get that little part of our lives together, he'll give us another challenge. Reality will give us another challenge. On that, we're going to learn the lessons, and the lessons is, I'll use your Lewis. The lessons always get harder. That whenever you conquer one lesson, whenever you learn one lesson, the next challenge is always more difficult. Because what seems to be happening in reality or with God, is that he's trying to get you to cobble together the competency that you need to move forward. That seems to be what the pursuit is. And for us to move forward, we have to have, in the end, we have to have a positive vision of what we want. We have to have a negative vision of what we don't want. There has to be an enemy that we're trying to defeat and leave in the past, or there has to be a positive vision of what we can become in the future. And without those two, we sort of stand still. And of course, as Lewis says, you're always advancing towards heaven or retreating towards hell. There are no sideways steps. And that's really where we leave ourselves. And so that's a little bit what that part is about. But yeah, I mean, I think it takes many of us like sort of a medical tragedy, something that we know we can't fix on our own, to see what really matters in life, to have the destructible threatened so that we might get a glimpse of the indestructible, to get a whiff of what this meaningless search for likes really is, for one vision of what a true love could be. I think oftentimes we dismiss facts as truth and we discard truth because it looks too much like hard work. And I think I say in the book that a million likes can never equal single love. So too, a million facts sometimes never equals a single truth. And so we've got to push on through these lesser things into the higher things. And that often comes in the form of not only sacrifice, but also trying to become more. And God will, it, I'm losing the Lewis line. He likes to use pain. Pain is his megaphone he uses to rouse the deaf world.
Yeah. So you just mentioned love, and where did I write down that quote? It was something about, it was when you were facing this medical challenge, and you talked about, maybe one of the greatest things in life is being able to lie in bed the night before a surgery and be able to put your hand in the hands of the one that you love. So without kind of spilling the beans on the whole dramatic, miraculous thing that happened, maybe you could talk a little bit about marriage and what you think. So I read almost half of the book before we got to talking today. So the second half of the book is also a mystery to me, but it did make me think about, you talk quite a bit about the love story of you and your wife. And I wondered if you'd like to just talk in general about what you've learned about marriage and what it means to love someone, what it means to sacrifice for someone.
I came to the conclusion, and I had to go back and edit the book in the first half of this, that we're called to live lavishly on the outliers of love and evil. I make the comment that you never send one bullet when you can send 100. Never send one rose when you can send 100 roses. You must live lavishly on the outliers of love and evil. There's something that's centering about finding love and pursuing love. And it's not only for myself to think about my wife and all the struggles and all that, she deals with me. I'm a hassle. I'm a real big problem.
I can imagine. I mean, my husband is like the original Energizer Bunny, and I have a feeling that the two of you have a lot in common. I mean, he never stops. And that's a great thing because I never have to have a honey-do list. Everything is done before I could ever even think about it. But on the downside, for someone like me, who I need a lot of time to think and cogitate, he's always on the go. So then I always feel like, oh, I should be on the go too. I should be doing stuff. It's really it, to get two people together on the same page is the challenge. So
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. But I think there's a theme throughout the book that if you want to get a glimpse, if you want to get a vision of what's true, you must retract your eyes from that which is false. Love works the very same way that love requires you to basically sacrifice all those potential relationships you could have and go all in on one love, one relationship. It's the same sense of trying to find truth. It's made in the sacrifice. And then once you get down to that sacrifice, if you identify who that one person may or may not be, you never know for sure. I mean, you might feel it. You might get this tingling in your soul, this tingling in your body. But you then get down to the sacrifice of yourself, the pieces of you, the wants, the desires, the inclinations for you to try to warp the other person into your desired vision of what a perfect woman or perfect man should be. And that's not love. That's not love. So then you got to rip that desire out of your life and embrace the person, not only for who they are, but for who they desire to become. And you do the same thing with that one you love that you did with yourself. You find out what her hopes and what his hopes and dreams are. And you ask that person, you begin to treat that person like they're that best possible version of themselves. And this is part of the Goddard philosophy, where you have to make, it's the law of assumption. You have to assume that that person is already the idyllic vision of who they desire to be. It's the Dante of treating Beatrice as she is already divine. It's the vision of us setting forth an ideal man as the ideal to worship and to emulate in scripture. We see these ideas pervasive, and also works on our individual relationships. So I don't see the mistakes. My wife doesn't, she sees the mistakes, but she doesn't call me out for the mistakes. And I'm blessed. I'm deeply blessed from that. I've got a woman that I don't deserve, but I have in my life. She sees the mistakes, and she loves me through that because she sees who I could become one day. But she also sees that our daughters are watching her love me and to forgive me and to overlook my mistakes. And she's training them on how to one day be a proper wife and be a mother. And so you begin to see this mirroring happening through the family, that happens, where me loving my daughters is also me loving my wife. Because not only do I see her image in them, but I know that her one desire is for me to be a good father to them. And also their one desire for me is to be a respectable, loving, providing husband for their mother, right? It's sort of this round. Dante goes and says that love is like a circle. And I think that's a little bit what he's talking about. But we never get a vision of that when we're on the periphery, when we're looking for that first person to date, or the first person to love, or that even that for that first person to ask out. And so, one of the things that I encourage people to ask themselves is, like, what would happen if I went to the nearest cafe and I sat there and bought 10 average looking single women a drink? And so I got one number. What would happen if I went and did all the oil changes for all the single mothers in my apartment complex without asking a dime, no strings attached? We have to eventually become the type of husband that those sorts of women would want to see their future husbands become. And the way that you do that is begin acting in the present like you would expect and hope to have yourself act in the future. That's a little bit what it's like. And I write a lot about love in the book, because love and evil, like, they're so, I mean, they're the opposites. I talk, obviously, beauty is the technical opposite, the inversion of evil. But love is, it's an incredible force, but also love is a sacrifice. And so we've got to talk about that, and we go in depth on that in the book.
Well, DC Schindler talks a lot about love and beauty is occupying the same space. So I'm not surprised that you came to that conclusion. He's working his way through Aquinas when he talks about that. And yeah, so like I said, I don't want to give away too much more from the book, but is there anything else that you would like to tell people about the book? Maybe why you decided to write it, what led you to that? Because I know it's a sacrifice in the midst of your schedule with all the businesses that you manage and all the things that you have going on and parenting your girls and being a good husband and just managing everything that's going on in your life, to take out time to sit down and write out a book, that's a big commitment of time.
It took me 2.5 years to write this book. 2.5 years. And it's not a very thick book. One of my goals was to try to distill knowledge, to make ideas as dense as possible, And like many people, like you and many people that watch this channel, I've read a little bit, and I was trying to tell a few, a while back. I think I've read 1,000 books to prepare to write one. But also, I've had a really different type of life, and I think you alluded to some of that in the book, and you'll read more as you progress through. I have some experiences, and I've been able to meet certain people that are people that I never thought I would get a chance to ever meet or talk to or learn from. And I try to do my best to approach those relationships and those conversations with an immense amount of humility. I'm naturally a very pride, very ego-driven person, and I've got to continually beat that down. But whenever I have approached those conversations, I realized that I learned a lot. I learned a lot. And so I think I had maybe conversations with 100 to 150 of the most competent people alive at various times. You mentioned Ben Carson. Ben Carson's been in this room multiple times. My office is up there. He's taken a nap on my couch in my office. He is, it is, we actually celebrated his wife Candy's birthday, her 70th birthday, just behind the room on the other side of those paintings. I had the cake there and everything. And so I say that not to brag, but just to say that God's put me in some crazy places to meet people that I'm not qualified to be in a room with. But if he puts me in there, even if it's on accident, even if God made a mistake, which I don't believe him, it's my duty to observe and to ask and to humble myself to see what sort of knowledge will cascade down, and maybe I'll get a drop of it. And so my desire in putting this book together is twofold. Number one is to take all that kind of real life example. I also done some stuff in the business world and in the international community as well, but also take it from a doer perspective, not as Paul Vanderclay said, Rick's not a pontificator, he's a doer. I'm taking it from the opposite domain, from Verveke and Peterson and people from that sort. I'm taking it from sort of the real world domain, where I don't really know the classical terminology, the technical terminology of what I've dealt with and what I've seen. But I know that these 50 some odd countries that I've done negotiations in and done work in over the years, I know that there are certain things that work and certain things that don't work, and there's certain truths, and I've been able to test some of those truths out in the wild. And so I wanted to first off write this book as a distilled and a compressed form of this. And you'll see like a lot of these quotes that maybe you were talking about, Karen. I worked really hard on getting the rhythm of the quotes right and taking out X, stripping out excess words. That's what really took 2, 2.5 years, is for me to delete stuff, delete words, delete letters, delete symbols. You'll see a lot of one word sentences in this book, because I'm trying to give you dense knowledge, but I'm also trying to give you memorable knowledge. I want you to remember that if a drop of hope exists somewhere, it threatens all threats everywhere. I want you to remember those sorts of truths, because not only are they true, but they're usable. Like you can recite that. You can tell a friend that's hopeless that, hey, I've got a bit of hope for you, and let my hope invade your present. Because if a drop of hope exists anywhere, it threatens all threats everywhere. It's a malleable. It's a fungible. Hope is a fungible thing that we get out there in the universe. And so that's what I wanted first. But the second thing I wanted is, dad of three girls. They're telling me, dad, some of these boys, they're not even thinking about girls. They're not even thinking about girls. And I see this, boys not around high school, but people that are maybe 10 years older, where there's no hope for love. There's no even, desire for it, it seems. And so what do we do? What do we do? And I'm assuming that that's going to get worse. And my kids are in middle school and high school. And I'm assuming that there's not going to be another father around that's going to be as intentional as I am. And I want the best for my daughters. And I figured if there's not going to be a man out there for my daughters to marry, I'm going to have to build a man. And if I could give him one thing to read, this is how you're a man. I want you to read this. And so this is the book that I'm going to give my sons-in-law one day to show them how to be a man. Not that I'm a perfect man, but that if you can see through my failures to see the hope that I had on the side of the failures, see what I've learned, so can you, right? If one man can be forgiven, so can you. If one man can be healed, so can you. If one man can rise from the dead, so can you. There's all these truths that are true. And so this is my effort to help that next generation, even the generation after them, to see what's possible for a man who makes a million mistakes but stays after it. Sometimes some of us are just too stupid to quit, so sometimes we win.
I love that. I love that whole thing. But I got stuck on this idea of your daughters not having anybody to marry because I've been thinking about this for a long time. On my channel, I've talked to a lot of young men who cannot find the women anywhere that are interested in getting married and having children because so many women today are trapped in the feminist mindset. That everything is about career and you want to work until you're 40 and then maybe think about getting married. Maybe think it, but by that time, children are kind of, for the most part, out of the question. So I've been thinking a lot about what can we do. And one of the conclusions that I came to, and I'm just going to throw this out because
Yeah.
maybe you're a person who has a lot more influence than I do. Maybe you can make this happen. There's two parts to this. One part is that I think that there's some way in which there is an ecumenism happening that is not based on compromise, but based on moving one level higher. And I see this happening in a lot of the churches around here. And we've been blessed recently to find we've always been in the Protestant tradition, but I have longed for a long time for some more liturgical kind of a service where there's, because I believe strongly in the reading of scripture. I believe strongly in communion every week. Very hard to find a contemporary Christian church outside the Catholic or Eastern Orthodox where those things happen. But we have found a Presbyterian church which has this beautiful liturgical service that's, so filled with the call to worship, the confession time, the teaching of the word, the whole liturgy is there, and so many young people coming, and it's just thriving, and the young people love the old music and the reading of scripture, and so I can kind of see this thing happening where maybe we can stop arguing with each other. Oh, I don't want my kid to marry that kind of a Christian, And if the pastors could come together, the pastors and the priests could come together in any community and say, we all know who our single people are, and we all know what kind of people they are, and we could talk with each other. I mean, sort of yenta, do the yenta thing, but with the pastors and the priests. Or if not that, at least maybe have three or four festivals a year where all the young people from all the churches could come together and there could be feasting and dancing and celebrating. I think something like that has to happen. We have to get to a place where they can meet in community, not just online, not just through some app, because the water cooler is gone. That's never coming back, right? Opportunity to meet at work is gone. That's never coming back because of the whole harassment thing and all of that stuff. So, what do you think about that?
I think that's genius. That's genius. I mean, it's that third place. And I don't think Starbucks is in third place. It's that third place that probably has the responsibility. If the second and the first are, you're home by yourself, you shouldn't be on an app looking for relationships. Maybe you are. I don't know. But that was before my time. But yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense because you have that like-mindedness. You also have that relationship there. You have a little bit of comfort there. I think that's good. I think that because of the apps, a lot of men have not experienced the excitement of rejection. Like just the
The
possibility of
excitement.
rejection.
That's
The
really
excitement
nice.
of rejection. Yeah, yeah,
Tickle
yeah,
that
yeah.
excitement. Okay, tell me more.
Well, I mean, it's that idea that a guy like me is going to get rejected more than I get accepted. I'll just tell you that. That's the way it was growing up. I got rejected a lot more than I was accepted by young ladies. And But there's always that anticipation of what if, like what if she says, yeah, I'll go have coffee with you. Or back in my, it was going to Sonic. It was going to Sonic for cherry limeade. There's always that hope. There's always that anticipation. And as long as there's a sort of a hope on the horizon, I hate that phrase, but I think it's a truism. There's that hope on the horizon that there's someone that will eventually say yes. I think we can keep pushing through that. But we've got to convince a whole generation of men that there's such a thing as a yes. They see it in people like you, and they see it in people like me, and maybe they're assuming that they're different, or they can never really imagine that happening for themselves. Just like I can never imagine what it would be like to get married before I was married. I never imagined like what it would like be like to have kids. But I think the idea that there's a possibility of a yes out there that could happen is sort of the first domino that has to fall before we can get down the line that there is potentially a woman that would one day love me for who I am, flaws and all. But there has to be such a thing as a yes at the start. And so I think it's that first step. It's that first little thing. And I've done a number of these. A lot of men, a handful of men in the corner have sort of reached out, and I've done, private video calls with them. They have something they want to start. They have something that they want to do. And, oftentimes they've got a million different ideas of what they could do, but there's not one thing that they want to do. And so trying to figure out that one thing is often like what's the first step? And this is why, like I say, go into your nearest coffee shop. Don't go pick an ideal coffee shop. Go to your nearest coffee shop and just look for the average looking women, the women you're not even attracted to. Like, just go look for them and just buy them coffees. And if you can't even approach them, just leave a $100 bill up there on the counter or a $20 bill on the counter and just buy and say, like, use this until it's gone. You've got to get started somewhere. And sometimes we just overconceptualize it. We just overthink it. And it's that overthinking that is the comfort. It's the apprehension. It's desire to not ever see any pain. It's the stalling, it's the delay that eats up decades, and decades become lives.
Well, and when you said just pick the average looking women that you're not attracted to, that made me think about your arbitrage thing, coming back to the beginning again. Undervalued assets that where there's really true value there, that and the way my husband always explained it to me, even when we were dating, because he said most of his friends had given up trying to date because they're so afraid of the no. So they just get a pizza and a video on Friday night. Used to be Blockbuster and pizza on Friday night, so they would avoid having to ask anybody. Because what was happening is that all the guys want the top 5% of the women. So they're all asking the same 5%. And they're getting all the no's. But there's still 95% of the women that are one, probably most of those are wonderful women who would make great mothers. But men are so visually oriented that they have to have somebody that meets their standard. But have they looked in a mirror lately? Right?
That's right.
So if you can just change your mindset and say, I'm looking for real value. I'm looking for, real value. I'm real looking for real beauty. I think that would create a lot of opportunity. And the same goes for women. Now, I mean, women aren't so visually oriented, but women are looking for men that present themselves as having a potential for success, potential to be able to care for their families. And so, men are judged on a much wider range of things. But women do still judge a man on first appearances at the beginning. But maybe we all just need to broaden our range of what we find meaningful in relationships. That would go a long way towards opening opportunity for people.
Definitely. And even to talk about it in the lowest possible condition, practice makes perfect. If you don't ever practice, you're not going to be good at any good at it. So that's why you go and you ask. 10 girls, and you go the next day, ask another 10 girls. You just keep at it. You just keep at it, because it helps you learn that you can do the things you don't want to do. It helps you learn that no's do not destroy you, and it also helps you realize that there are women who are actually will reward you for taking a chance, to taking a risk. And some of them are incredibly attractive and have incredibly, far out types of potential men that they could land, but those men are not there in that coffee shop at that time, and you are. And you never know what's going to happen.
That's a
You
great
never
one.
know what's going to happen.
So there's this great movie with Bill Macy. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I can't remember the name of it, but he plays a young man with cerebral palsy who strongly desires to be a salesman. And so he's finally gets a chance to be a door-to-door salesman for something like Watkins, where you go door-to-door and you sell these products. And in the sales training, they taught him there's going to be 250 no's for every yes. So he'd get a lot of no's because he looked odd. His mannerisms were odd. He had a strange facial expression because of his handicap. He shuffled along. He was awkward. So most people would just slam the door in his face. But he'd turn away from that and big smile on his face. And he'd come home to his mom and she'd say, "Why are you smiling?" And he said, "I got seven no's today. I'm closer to the yes." He ended up being their top salesman, getting all kinds of awards. And this is a true story. It's based on a true story because he knew that every no got him closer to a yes.
Yes, I love that. Yeah, you purchase yeses with noes.
Oh,
Noes are
that's
the
a great.
currency of
You have a
yeses.
hand. You're very good at putting that stuff together. You purchase yeses with no's.
Yeah.
Well, so what's the big yes you're going after in your life right now?
Yeah, so I'm trying to get this book to 10,000 sales is really that's my like my long-term vision. To show you how low I was thinking, how low I was aiming, we had 5,000 on Amazon alone in the first 2 weeks. They say most authors only sell 300 copies their whole careers. I was thinking too low, I was aiming too low. But I think we had a little bit of an algorithm kick. I'm not sure what it was there. Things have slowed down a little. Obviously, you always have a kind of peak at the launch and there. So I'm really pushing forward to see if we could get to 10,000 by the end of the year. That's my number one priority. I got a lot of stuff happening at work. We're developing some buildings, trying to find more buildings to develop. Always meeting, I have investors that invest in these different properties, these different funds that I run with my team. And so I'm always dealing with sort of those sorts of meetings as well. I've got three of them this week. And so that's always a focus. But I think trying to get just figure out this book sales business. It's a different business. I'm not very good at it. So I'll give you an idea. I know you're a numbers person. So they say that like when you run ads, like I'm trying to figure out Amazon ads. They say when you run ads, you should expect about a 10% conversion rate. So if someone clicks to go to your book, they should buy about 10% of the time. I think right now my conversion rate's like 0.7%. And so like I'm thinking to myself, like, all right, so I'm like 1/15 of what it should be, what average is. What do I do? What do I do? It's not very efficient to run ads. But I've got to prioritize, like, what's the efficient thing to do? Is to run the ads at a break even or a profit, or is it for me to be able to hit that 10,000 number? Because once I hit the 10,000 number, I free myself to go do other things. That's sort of the deal that I made with myself, that I could start working on the next big project. Maybe it's a book. It probably will be another book because I really enjoyed the process. But after I hit 10,000, then I can free myself to go do that. But I've got to just sort of focus on marketing and plugging the book with my spare time until then. And so that's what I decided to do. Like, if you're telling me it's going to cost me 15 times more because my conversion rate is so lousy, I guess we're going to do it. I guess we're going to be wasteful with money.
Oh
And
no, there are better ways. Maybe we can talk about that
I'm interested. I'm interested. But the best thing so far has been this little newsletter that I started up last April. That's been the best out of all of
Been the
them.
what that you started up?
This little email newsletter
Oh.
that I started up last April. That's moved a lot of books. And that's actually been pretty successful. But like the X ads and the Facebook ads, you'll sell books on that, but the conversion rates aren't very high. Same thing with the Amazon ads. And so
Yeah.
it's been a challenge. So I guess that's sort of been a little bit, it's a start. It's sort of like a one-off startup for me is the way I'm approaching it. It's a business I got to learn very, very quickly before I spend all my money.
Well, so if anybody does want to buy, I'll put in the show notes places that they can buy the book and your email, your website address, and anything else that you want to tell people about where they can find your book.
Yeah, so it's at Walmart, it's at Barnes and Noble online, it's at Waterstones in Britain. But yeah, Amazon is probably the main place that folks will go. We got a hardback. I have an audiobook edition as well. Depending on when this releases, there's a lot of Kindle sales that are run. I can't control the prices on other sorts of formats, but the Kindle I've got a little bit of control over. So for instance, I think this week and next week, it's 99 cents on Kindle, just because I'm trying to get the idea out, the ideas of the book out. And then it's there. But and if someone can't afford the book, reach out to me. And I've had a number of people reach out to me, say, Rick, I can't afford the book. Message me on LinkedIn or something or Twitter, and I'll just send you a copy of the book. And so because
But
I
your
really
goal for
believe.
this isn't to make money. Your goal for this is to get it read by people.
I'm so inefficient and bad at this, Karen. There's no way I'm making any money on this. Don't tell my wife. Don't tell my wife. That's all that I ask.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I wonder if we could talk for just a minute offline. So I'm gonna close this down and thank everybody for paying attention. And I always forget to tell people at the beginning, but if this kind of content interests you, like and subscribe. I'm not very good at the marketing thing either. And we'll talk offline here for a second. So,
That's right.
tally-ho, everybody.